Today's program was brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm in Vermont, a producer of award-winning handmade cheese from goat and cow milk. For more information, visit ConsiderBardwellFarm.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, this is Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd. It's the monthly book review show, our last Friday afternoon show. We're moving to Mondays at 2 on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. This week, I'm welcoming Gordon Edgar. Gordon, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Great. So I want to tell the listeners that Gordon is the author of Cheesemonger, A Life on the Wedge, and a longtime cheesemonger and cheese buyer at San Francisco's Rainbow Grocery Collective. So how you doing?
Good. I'm just sitting around here trying to figure out where one of my orders is today. But besides that, I'm with you 100%.
Okay. How's the weather in San Francisco?
It is actually still really warm here. It's kind of unbelievably still warm. We had like a cold day, and then it got warm again.
Oh, we're finally
not so great for the cheese, you know.
Right, we're finally.
I was trying to explain to people that you know, all the East Coast vendors try to sell us, Alpine cheese this time of year, like in September, early October, and I'm like, this is our summer. Sell me mozzarella.
You're still barbecuing.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, well, today I want to talk about your book. How did you decide to write this book?
Well, you know, it's kind of a long process. Back in probably about 2002, I had a blog, and it was just like a personal blog. I just kind of wrote whatever came into my mind. I think the first entry, I'm pretty sure, was about how weird it is when you're on public transit and the person next to you is reading porn. You know, just little observations, things like that. And then as I kind of wrote more and more people found my blog and people realized I worked in cheese, people started being obsessed with the cheese entries.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a lot back in the early 2000s. There wasn't a lot of people on the internet talking about cheese,
right?
And certainly not many with kind of professional level information.
Mm-hmm.
So at one point I put it out there. I'm like, oh well, you know, ask me your cheese questions. And I got so many cheese questions in like a half hour that I had like over 100 that I was just like, okay, I'm just going to pretend I didn't do this. I didn't have the time to answer all those questions. But what I realized was that there was like a real demand there for people to have kind of demystified information
mm-hmm.
about
mm-hmm.
cheese in an accessible manner.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a real need for people.
Now, was your blog also feeling free to be political?
Oh yeah, no, it was you know, it had everything in my life. I mean,
okay.
my current, website, I definitely write about cheese sometimes, although I don't think I have for the last month or so. But that's pretty much cheese focused,
mm-hmm.
but back then it was just whatever came to mind, and back then on the internet, you know, things weren't quite so crazy. You know,
right.
You could kind of write things and people wouldn't necessarily find them.
Right. But I think what's unique about your book is that it's from a different perspective than most cheese books because of your anti-establishment background and political background. So you bring the punk perspective to the cheese world.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think there's a lot in common with, there's different aspects to the punk scene historically, and there's different parts of it. And I was always in the kind of more, the more DIY,
mm-hmm.
political end of the punk scene. And there's just a lot of similarity between that and, people trying to make cheese, you
mm-hmm.
know. I definitely found, not an identical, but a similar kind of community there
mm-hmm.
In the cheese world. I think I mentioned this in my book, but, it's like, in the 80s and early 90s, I was like sleeping on my friends' floors, and going to punk shows or doing political organizing. And in the late 90s, early 2000s, I was, you know, sleeping on the cheesemaker's floors. Right.
So it's just more of the same.
Yeah. Well, I definitely think there's similarity. What really fascinated me, you know, I mean, I live and work in San Francisco, and I grew up in the Bay Area, so I've really, you know, lived in this kind of California, North Bay environment my whole life. And what I really found fascinating with working with cheese was really, you know, having relationships with people who weren't in that kind of urban area. And I felt like I just learned so much, and a lot of, you know, a lot of stupid preconceptions I had. You know, you just grow up and you know, you don't really know people in other places, you know. Right. I really learned a lot, and I really, you know, really appreciate that part of what I do.
That it takes you out of your normal day-to-day.
Takes me out of the Bay Area bubble. You know, and it also, like, you know, it's real. It's real when, you know, you get, you know, a local cheesemaker calls you up and is like, he knows his work. We're a co-op, and so, you know, we tend to pay our bills on time really fast. You know, ask anybody, co-ops pay their bills really quickly. And you know, so we'll get a call occasionally from, you know, a local farmer or something and be like, hey, can I send you an order direct? Because they know they'll get payment, you know, in 7 days, and they can use that money, you know, to pay the mortgage, you know, and I mean, that's just one example, and I don't necessarily want to put that out there as a service we offer.
Everyone would call
that. But you know, you know, being able to do that kind of real support for farmers is just really, it's a really incredible part of working in cheese.
Now, back when you were writing the book, I presume you were working full time.
Oh, yes. Yeah, definitely.
How did you write it? How did you plan it? Did you have deadlines? Did you have a contract beforehand?
Well, you know, because I didn't have much writing credits to my name, what I decided to do was write the whole book and then try to sell it. Because I didn't honestly think anybody would give me the benefit of the doubt for me being able to complete the book. So I had an outline in my head. I had an idea of how I wanted to do it. I wanted to do kind of I wanted to have it be part memoir so that it would be really accessible by non-cheese people. I wanted to kind of go at issues not really in a chronological way, but in a kind of a different kind of way. It basically took me about 2.5 years working mostly on my days off in the mornings, and then taking a couple of vacations where they weren't really vacations. They were vacations that I went and just sat in my room and wrote for a couple of weeks. Probably in taking two of those kind of 2-week vacations is probably when I wrote about 2/3 of the book. Okay. So
how did the book change as you were writing it?
Oh boy. I think, you know, a lot of things that were really, you know, when you start out in cheese, especially when you start out, I'm almost at 20 years in the cheese world now. And when I started out, you know, there wasn't a lot of information out there. So a lot of things that my sales reps told me or that I kind of picked up kind of in the oral tradition, I would mention them, and then I'd be like, whoa, you know, I don't actually know if this is true or not. And so it made me go back and actually look into those kind of examples and those kind of stories that I'd heard.
So you had to research to make sure you were telling the truth.
Yeah, I had to do some research. I just had to figure out what was apocryphal stories and what were actually true stories. And, you know, sometimes I couldn't tell, but I realized that it would be very easy for me to spread misinformation unless I researched the things that I had been taught. And, you know, there's just so much more information out there about cheese now than there was back in the back when I started, that it's that it really was good to have that kind of refresher.
Right.
So I'd say it, you know, really improved me as a cheese buyer too.
Now, did you always have the two cheeses in the end of each chapter, or did someone suggest you add that?
No, that was funny. That actually was added by the that was like kind of a stipulation when I signed my contract.
They wanted some
cheese recommendations. I was kind of resisting that because I kind of like being well, it's like me and the academics, right? It's like it's like me and Paul Kinstead oh God, why am I blanking on this? the Secret Life of Cheese.
Heather Paxton.
You know, we're like the people who write the cheese books without pictures.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I was kind of into that. I wrote the book, and the first person I approached about selling it You know, the response back I got, it wasn't really a good fit. It was kind of, I had this personal connection, so I just thought I'd go for it.
Uh-huh.
And the response that I got back was like, well, let's cut out all the stories and put in a bunch of pictures and make it a coffee table book.
Oh, that was not what you had in mind.
Yeah, I just wasn't really interested in that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So I kind of left out that stuff that I think was a really good addition to the book, to be honest, but I kind of was
feeling willful about it. Uh-huh. I assumed that almost, because it's just, it's in different type, and it's just affixed to each chapter. Though you can hear your voice in it. You can definitely hear your voice in the descriptions, and they are right. mentioned usually in the chapter, but it was like, where'd these come from?
But I actually do think it was a good addition, and I do think it makes it it made it even more accessible, which
right.
really was
right.
the goal. And so I definitely support that. But the fact that it didn't even occur to me just was kind of where I was at when I uh-huh. was writing the book. And I don't know if you know this, but I actually sold the book twice.
Oh,
I sold the book to a company that then during the economic recession. I guess I shouldn't say they went out of business, because mm-hmm. I think they still exist in some form,
mm-hmm.
but they stopped putting out books. And
then you had to sell it again?
And
then you had to sell it all over again?
Yeah, well, my book was in limbo for about almost a full year, where it was done but not printed. And I never got paid for that contract I signed. And,
right.
Finally, luckily I had an agent, and my agent was able to get my rights back so I could resell it to Chelsea Green, Chelsea Green is a much better fit anyway. And
yeah.
Chelsea Green really seems to be the place that's, you know, putting out, really interesting cheese books
yes.
these days. So
yes.
I'm really happy
and
I ended up there.
Interesting
farm all for
books,
the better.
Farm books, food books, they're kind of,
absolutely.
You know, and politically they seem to be somewhat like-minded also.
Right, you know, and they're actually a worker-owned company now. They're not a co-op, but they're worker-owned. They just kind of switched their structure. So it's really great to be together with them in that way.
Great. Now, how has having published this book changed your life?
Well, kind of yes and no in terms of changing my life. I mean, I get a lot of people who come in the store who are like, oh, you're still here.
Uh-huh.
as if like somehow putting out a book on Chelsea Green means that I didn't have to work anymore. So in that level, it's pretty much the same. You know, I'm still mm-hmm. I'm still here, like Saturday nights, mucking out the coolers. You know,
uh-huh.
but what it really has done, I don't want to downplay this. I mean, it's just it's been great. I mean, I think the reception I've gotten, especially from store level cheese
mm-hmm.
workers,
mm-hmm.
Has been tremendous, and mm-hmm. it just makes me so happy that I could, you know, put something out there that other cheese workers, especially people who work the floor, you
right.
know, like me,
mm-hmm.
Really appreciate. And that's, to me, that's really the most special thing about it.
Mm-hmm.
I really, really, really appreciate that. I really, really appreciate the support I've gotten from people who've read it.
Mm-hmm. Have you felt any, like, infringement on your privacy?
Well, you know, it's most people who write books don't work on the retail floor at very specific hours every week. So there have been a couple of issues, but
mm-hmm.
overall, it's been pretty okay.
Right? Have any of the bad
you know,
shoppers
somebody
spotted
who,
themselves in your and come confronted you? Any of the bad shoppers?
No. Those the bad shoppers. I wasn't worried about that because I fictionalized their appearances.
Oh, okay.
Enough. That was the only thing that was like at all fictionalized in the book. Was like, I didn't want like somebody to be like, hey, that's me.
Uh-huh.
The stories are all true, but the like appearances and things like that are a little changed. But no, it was more like there was a couple of different things. Mostly it was really positive. Mostly people were really supportive and be like, hey, I like the book. The book's awesome. You know, thank
mm-hmm.
you for writing it. But occasionally there was a couple of people who were just like, I have some issues with the book. I want to tell you why I don't
mm-hmm.
think this is right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think most other published writers have to deal with that. Like, especially in a retail setting where, you know, that's not really the mode of communication
mm-hmm.
is, that kind of direct exchange of
ideas
of political ideas or whatever.
Uh-huh.
So,
uh-huh. What was the most fun about writing the book? What parts were the most fun to write?
You know, I guess, you know, it's funny. It's I get great satisfaction from writing, but I'm not necessarily sure fun, like, was the main adjective I'd use for it. I mean, I think that I think that when I would write something and read it back the next day and be like, oh yeah, you know, that's what I meant to say. I mean, you know, that's a very kind of
so the satisfaction
almost narcissistic like way to look at it. It's like you know, it's I really appreciated that. I felt like I could put on paper what a lot of people I knew who work in cheese, you know, were thinking and stuff like that. And I really, that was my favorite part about it, feeling like I didn't write it necessarily to represent other people besides myself, but I was hoping that other people would appreciate it. And I think that that was definitely the most fun and satisfying things when, you know, I'd show like my coworkers like some part of it and they'd be like, oh yeah, that's great, you know, and I really felt like I was on the right track, I'd say. Mm-hmm.
What were the hardest parts? Did you save some parts for last?
You know, it wasn't so much that parts of it were hard, I don't think, as much as keeping the faith that I could do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because, you know, going from, you know, the longest thing I'd ever have had published before, you know, was probably, you know, a couple thousand words.
Mm-hmm.
Going from that to writing something that's like 250 pages with no contract is definitely a leap of faith, you know. There was definitely times when, you know, self-doubt would creep in, and I'd be like, you know, oh, am I just fooling myself? Is anybody going to read this, or anybody want to publish this? And I just kind of kept going because I really felt like, you know, I kind of had to say it. You know, I had to write it one way or another. You know,
now,
so.
What kind of student were you, may I ask? Like, was writing papers your strong point? Were you an English major?
In high school, I was on the school paper.
Oh, okay, good.
And we had a very, you know, we're in the Bay Area and everything like that. Mm-hmm. We had a very, like, we had, you know, our journalism teachers were like, yeah, let's get the school administration. So it was definitely like...
Oh, okay. Right up your alley.
Well, it helped form me. They were really great writing teachers. They really taught me a lot. You know, I would say that my high school journalism teachers probably taught me the most about writing. But after...
Have you sent them a book?
Sorry?
You should send them a book.
Oh yeah, no, I've communicated with them since when it came out.
They must be very proud.
There was a high school. I went to a high school called Redwood because, you know, I'm from California, and the high school newspaper was called the Bark, the Redwood Bark, right? And there was actually a reunion, which there hadn't been before, but it happened right around the time the book was coming out. So that was a really nice thing to thank my journalism teachers.
Oh, great. Okay, we're going to take a break.
Okay.
We'll be back in a few moments with Gordon Edgar on Cutting the Curd, discussing Cheesemonger, A Life on the Wedge.
Today's program has been brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm.
Spanning the rolling hills of Vermont's Champlain Valley and easternmost Washington County, New York, 300-acre Consider Bardwell Farm was the first cheese-making co-op in Vermont, founded in 1864 by Consider Stebbins Bardwell himself. Rotational grazing on pesticide-free and fertilizer-free pastures produces the sweetest milk and the tastiest cheese. All of their cheeses are aged on the farm in their extensive system of caves.
Consider Bardwell Farm is also a big supporter of Heritage Foods USA's No Goat Left Behind program. No Goat Left Behind is a serious effort launched in 2011 by Heritage Foods USA, designed to introduce goat meat to American diners and provide a sustainable end market for dairy animals.
For more information, please visit www.considerbardwellfarm.com.
Hi, Gordon. We're back.
I'm back too.
Oh, good, good. So anyway, so I said before, I think what makes your book so special is your outside the mainstream perspective, how you're integrating your progressive politics into both a cheese world and a grocery store, albeit a worker collective. Could you imagine having started cheesemongering at a more traditional store?
You know, that's a great question. I mean, you know, it's funny because how I came about working at Rainbow was that, you know, I'd kind of been working kind of just nothing jobs. I was working at like a photo lab. I was a photographic printer, and you know, that kind of talk about a dead industry there. But I was doing that as I wanted a lot of time to work on other projects, other activism, other like things I was doing. And one of the reasons that I wanted to work at Rainbow was because I wanted to work in, you know, what is a really large-scale experiment in workplace democracy. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to work here before I wanted to work in cheese. I mean, I got with the job in cheese because that's where the opening was.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no, I mean, I kind of talk about this in the book a little bit, but I had, you know, I had no particular love for cheese mm-hmm. before I started working mm-hmm. in cheese. And it was the exposure to it that really got me excited and got me excited about working in cheese mm-hmm. for, you know, the rest of my life, you mm-hmm. know?
Right.
But I don't think what I wasn't looking for a job at a grocery store. I was looking for a job at the worker-owned cooperative.
Right.
So I doubt that I would have gotten my start in a more traditional grocery store.
Right. Do you think you could ever segue to a different, more traditional environment?
Oh, I don't know.
I mean, I'm not interviewing you.
You know, are you offering me a job?
No. No, not on the radio.
What I love about this place is, you know, it's part of the community. It's, mm-hmm. It's, you know, I see, you know, just last night I was working the closing shift last night, and you know, it was my regular shift, and I saw a bunch of people who I hadn't seen in a few months, and I don't know these people. You mm-hmm. know, I just know them as customers, you mm-hmm. know, and I know, I'm like, hey, where's your daughter today? And he's like, oh, you know, my daughter's 13. She doesn't want to shop with me anymore. You know, just like those kind of conversations, which, mm-hmm. you know, it'd be really hard to leave this place. I
right.
mean, not just for the work, but just, you know, the community involved uh-huh. in it. Mm-hmm. I never say never. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I'm not actively looking for anything.
Right.
But, you know.
No, I just meant, you know, sort of, is the collective nature of the store, you know, the most important part to you? Or has cheese taken over sort of now you're so into cheese it doesn't matter as much?
Right. No, I see what you're asking. Yeah. No, you know, I think that, you know, I do love cheese mm-hmm. as well as cooperatives. It's hard to say I love one more than another.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I would leave it there in terms right, of future right. things. You know, it's like, you know, I love this place. I've been here 20 years,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's a long time
yeah.
To be in one place. But you know, you never know what's going to happen. I mean, especially in this city,
right.
in San Francisco, and the way that the rents are, the way that evictions happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I lose my apartment, you know, mm-hmm. I plan on staying in the Bay Area. I plan on staying in the city, but I've seen too many of my friends have to leave the area to say that, you know, oh, I have to work at Rainbow for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Not to get depressing.
Right.
Again, I don't have
right.
any plans to leave,
right.
but.
Okay. Now, how is your cheese selection in the store dictated by your particular store customers' expectations and needs?
Well, you know, it's interesting because we're actually one of the least organic parts of our
okay.
store in
mm-hmm.
terms of the food, kind of us in the wine section, beer and wine section, you know, and it's definitely different. I mean, our produce is probably 95% organic,
mm-hmm.
And there's just not that much variety of organic cheese enough to supply
right. Right.
kind of the interested Bay Area grocery store consumer.
Right.
You know, if we had, if we were limited to just organic cheese, I mean, and there are some great ones out there, but if we were limited to just that, you know, we really wouldn't have much of a cheese section
mm-hmm.
At this point. And I hate to say this because I think that there are a lot of people making really good organic cheese,
mm-hmm.
but you know, organic cheese and organic wine are very similar in the way that they have a bad reputation.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually have customers who when, you know, with either of those products, organic wine or organic cheese, they'll kind of be like, ah, well, it's probably not as good as the non-organic one.
Okay.
You know, if it's a similar style of cheese.
Right, even though they're purposely in your grocery store looking for exactly. your other products.
I mean, there's a level of craft. I mean, we all know this. We're cheese people here, right? I mean, there's a level of craft, you know, in terms of making and aging, especially an aged cheese, that is not quite the same as, and not that there isn't, not that there isn't skill involved in growing organic apples or something like that, but, you know, it's not, you know, cheese obviously is not a raw ingredient. It's a, you know, it's a formed ingredient. So it's, you know, it's just a different level of things, and I'm not sure, there are not, I would love there to be more very skilled organic cheese makers.
Right.
And again, I'm not putting down the ones that exist.
Well, organic doesn't mean anything about taste necessarily.
Well, no, and you know, for the most part, the organic dairy industry is making commodity style cheeses.
Right.
I mean, they're making, you know, Jack's, Cheddar's, and, you know, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those have a big part of our market in the store,
because
those have gotten to the place where they're comparable flavor wise in that commodity style. But, you know, and we carry a Parmigiano Reggiano, and we carry an organic Parmigiano Reggiano. You know, and, you know, I will tell you straight up that the non-organic one is the better cheese, you know. So that's a little tough.
Right.
You know, that's a tough conversation with some
people.
Customers.
Now, what about animal rennet? Is that a bigger issue in your grocery store because there's no meat and no fish, correct?
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny because I don't know if it was intentional or not. This was way before my time here, but for whatever reason, the original founders of the store decided that they would make an exception for animal rennet in the store. And yeah, you're right. We don't carry meat or fish. We carry we have rennet in the cheese. We have gelatin capsules, and we have pet food. You know, those are the only those are the only like animal dead animal products in the store.
Okay.
And you know, so it's there's no real push to like make us stop carrying cheeses with animal rennet, thankfully.
Do you
but
mark
it definitely
them?
Is something that we have to be very on top of for customers and know what kind of rennet we have because there's definitely some strict vegetarians.
Right. Do you separate it in the case?
No, but everything's labeled.
Okay. And would you say, do you know offhand if you have a higher percentage of vegetarian rennet than, you know, a routine store?
Probably than a routine store. I mean, you know, it's funny because, I mean, I really think we've seen in the cheese world a huge shift towards using traditional animal rennet amongst the small, you know, artisan cheesemakers over the last few years. And that really, I don't believe that, I mean, that is not my experience that was the case 10 years ago. But now it seems like every great new cheese coming up, almost every one of them is using animal rennet. You know, we're kind of reflecting that in that, you know, we're looking for really high quality cheese, you know, and I think that, you know, it's been demonstrated to me that certain cheeses will taste better with animal rennet, you know.
Okay. Another part of the book that I loved is when you were talking about going to cheesemakers and aging rooms, and you said that walking into an aging room feels like church.
Well, you know, what do I know about church, really?
But I understood what you meant. What other selling professions engender the type of enthusiasm that we have in the cheese world, do you think?
Boy, I don't know. I mean, this is slightly off topic, but I think it's the same thing. You know, what really struck me, you know, when I first started going to like cheese events, you know, the American Cheese Society conference, things like that, you know, it was really alienating to me. Like, I wasn't necessarily choosing to be part of that world. I didn't know anybody there. I didn't know what it would be like. I thought it would be a lot more just like, you know, people trying to sell me stuff, you know. And once I realized like what a community it was and what a, you know, a community of mutual aid, which always appeals to me. I mean, people are really trying to help each other for the most part, and realizing that, you know, we all get along better if we all help each other a little bit. So I would say that the cheese world is special, and I agree that there's something You know, like I was writing about going to the aging rooms and things like that. There's something about it that lends itself to, like, wow, we're doing something special. We're doing something important.
Mm-hmm.
And not, people mm-hmm. might not understand that. Not everybody might understand that. Probably people who listen to this radio show do. But you know, other people don't know. You know, they might
right.
laugh. You're like, oh, you work in cheese. That's funny.
Right.
You know,
they
but,
think
crazy. But you know, it's really is something special. And you go into those aging rooms, especially the first time you go and see, like, I mean, it's been a while for me now, but first time you go and see, like, you know, a cheese that you've always eaten being made, and you'd like watch the process, and you smell it, and you're mm-hmm. like there, you're feeling the humidity, you know, you're that just the
right.
whole room is filled with that milk smell, and you know, I mean, it's just something really
it's
incredible.
It's very exciting. It's very exciting.
Yeah.
It makes me feel like pinching myself. I was thinking about Heather Paxton's book Life of Cheese, and she discusses the concept that both the creators and the consumers of new food, which is, you know, anything local, slow, organic, unprocessed, we are embracing and expressing a value system. Do you think that's true? Do you think that's sort of more yuppie bullshit or also somewhat true?
I think that it is... I think that there's truth to it, for
mm-hmm.
sure. I mean, I love her book. I think
mm-hmm.
her book is fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I didn't like about her book was that I didn't write certain parts of it that she did. Because I was reading it and going, damn, she put it so much better than me. I was trying to get that thing across.
It's a hard book, but I saw a lot in common.
I mean, what I'm really wary of as a retailer... I'm sorry.
I see a lot in common in your books. You're saying it a much more accessible way, and she's got her anthropological way. But there was a lot of overlap of content.
Oh yeah, no, for sure. And you know, I'm working on a next book too. And you know, honestly, there's some even more overlap in there, which
What's the topic?
I was like, you know, when I was reading the book, I was like, oh man, this. You know, and then I realized, oh, I can just quote this. I don't have to write it. But what I was going to say was that I think that you know, as a retailer, what I really worry about is passing on bad information to customers.
Mm-hmm.
So with that whole, like, you know, people, you know, are doing this process, you know, in order to kind of live their beliefs. I believe that. I believe that people definitely do that. What I'm wary of is telling customers that when it's not true. And so my angle is a little different than Heather's is, because I'm, you know, I feel like I'm kind of a guardian of, you know, the public trust in that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
You know, when I'm selling a cheese, I do want to know. You know, I'm not necessarily going to, like, you know, talk down a cheese because it's a larger production cheese or whatever, but I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to be selling something like, oh, this is the terroir of this area when they're buying, you know, frozen curds from all over the world.
Right.
You know, I mean, to me, that's not good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I really have to watch with that, because I think that the more people get into this cheese world as a way to live those beliefs, the more there will also be people trying to take advantage of that to sell things that aren't that.
Right, right. That's true. Well, I want to thank you very much for coming on the show. Gordon Edgar, author of Cheesemonger, A Life on the Wedge. Can't wait to read your new book, and you can come back.
Well, yeah, well, I'm hoping to sign a contract within the next couple of weeks, so hopefully you'll be hearing about it soon.
Okay, great. This is our last Friday show of Cutting the Curd. We're moving to Mondays at 2 p.m. My next guest will be November 18th, will be Sue Conley, author with Peg Smith of the just-published Cowgirl Creamery Cooks. Thanks to the engineer, Diedrich. And podcasts are available on iTunes and Stitcher. This is Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd on heritageradionetwork.org. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.